I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. What do you do for work after holding the unique position of press secretary for the President of the United States? And really, can any other job compare? Today, we'll ask someone who might know, Josh Earnest, the man who held the job for more than 3 years under President Barack Obama. We'll also see what he thinks of the current presidential press team. Then, a conversation about access to activism. We'll find out how groups like Stand Up KC are getting low-wage workers intimately involved in the movement, and we'll see if that's affected their success in the fight to boost the minimum wage. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There's a White House tradition passed on presidency after presidency, one position found in every administration whose occupant hands over a garment to the next. It's a flak jacket, at least purportedly it is, with a bulletproof lining, which the White House press secretary leaves in the closet for his or her successor. Josh Earnest wore that jacket for the last 3 years or so of Barack Obama's presidency, and now, just over a year since he left the press secretary job and left that flak jacket in the closet for Sean Spicer, Josh Earnest is here with us today. Welcome to Up to Date.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm doing well. Good to talk with you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, yeah, you actually leave a note as part of leaving that jacket, too, don't you?
That's right. There was actually some recent reporting at the end of last year that the flak jacket has gone missing.
I saw
so,
that.
So I don't know. I don't know what the fate of the infamous flak jacket is these days.
I think I heard it was found, but maybe the collection of notes is still missing.
Oh, that could be. That could be. I was unaware of the tradition about tucking the notes into the jacket. You know, I think the original idea had been that future press secretaries could draw upon the combined wisdom of previous press secretaries by reading the notes that they had left for their successor.
Yeah.
But the only note that I saw was the one that was from my predecessor that he left on the desk. I left a note on the desk of the press secretary's office for Sean on my last day in the White House.
What did you say? Do you mind telling us what you said to Sean Spicer?
I mean, in general, what I told Sean was that I tried to reflect on my own experience and the kinds of things that I derived from having the real honor of holding that responsibility. And, you know, I conveyed to him the importance of, in a high-pressure job like that, trying to have some fun and taking the responsibilities seriously, but not taking yourself too seriously. And I'll leave it to your listeners to decide whether or not he followed that advice.
Some would say that he did not appear to be having a lot of fun on a number of occasions.
Yeah, and there were certainly some things that he confronted rather uniquely that would have made it hard to have too much fun in his role. I think that, you know, it is clear after a year that both Sean and Sarah, in their role as White House press secretary, while we had the same title, I think the job and set of responsibilities that they have is quite different than the responsibilities that I fielded when I held that title.
What do you mean? I mean, they're still giving press briefings. They're still wrangling the journalists from all across the spectrum.
They are, but I think that their day-to-day is probably a little bit different. And I, you know, speaking most broadly, I think what is striking to me, or has been striking to me, is the degree to which the Trump administration's engagement with the media has been focused on the kind of persona that President Trump himself assumes when he's in public, which is to say, he doesn't spend a lot of time using the platform of the presidency to drive a bigger argument about what he thinks the country should be doing, or his vision for the future of the country, or what we can do to best position the country and our citizens for the future. He spends a lot of time making assertions that are usually pretty controversial and often contradicted by the facts. He spends a lot of time making promises, some of which are attainable, many of which are not. You know, and that was that was very different than what I viewed as my responsibility. And I think it was quite different than what President Obama viewed as his responsibility. He viewed his engagement with the media as, one, an opportunity for the media to hold him and his administration accountable for wielding the authority that the American people had given him. But he also viewed it as an opportunity to make a broader argument about what he was doing, why he was doing it, and where he thought the country should be headed. And, you know, that's... that's not often what we get from the Trump White House.
Well, I mean, in a way, what's similar about those two things is that both presidents are trying to use the media. I don't mean that in an overly disparaging way, but trying to use the media for their purposes to advance their message. What seems to be different, and tell me if this seems right, is the level of respect being shown to the media in that process.
I think that is one very important difference. It is undeniable that President Obama was frustrated at times by the coverage that he received as President of the United States. I think that was true of his 43 predecessors as well.
Yes.
Every president is frustrated by the way that they're covered by the media. And the truth is, if they weren't, Brian, that'd be a pretty good indication that the press wasn't doing their job. Their job is to make people in power uncomfortable and to ask tough questions, even when it's inconvenient. And you could argue, actually, especially when it's inconvenient. But President Trump seems to have a different approach. He ends up feeling quite frustrated about any press coverage that doesn't make him look great. And that puts him in a position of saying things that, frankly, are in direct contradiction to the United States Constitution, saying things like the press is the enemy of the state isn't just troubling. It's also in a direct contradiction to what our founding fathers envisioned that independent journalists would play in our democracy.
I do want to ask you. Last time you were on the program, which was a few months ago, that was just right at the end of Sean Spicer's time as press secretary. Sarah Huckabee Sanders has now had several months to grow into the role. I mean, do you have an assessment of, even within the different constraints she's operating under than maybe you were? How's she doing?
Yeah, what I would say about her performance is I think one of the things that she brings to the table that Sean didn't quite is that Sean took over a White House press operation. Well, let me back up and say it this way. Sean took over at the beginning. So he was responsible not just for doing the job from day one, but also building the apparatus and the operation around him to support him. And, you know, your listeners may recall that when he actually took over the job, there was no White House communications director in place and that he was essentially fulfilling both functions. And typically what the White House communications director does in the White House is to handle the long term planning, to sort of focus on how are we setting a broader narrative in terms of us telling a story about what the president hopes to be doing for the country. And the press secretary has more of what could also be likened to like a firefighting role.
Yeah.
What's in the news that day? How do we make an argument today to make sure that people understand that we're still on track? And trying to do both of those jobs is, frankly, is an invitation to fail at both of those jobs.
Yeah.
And so that put him at a real disadvantage coming in. So what I do think that Sarah has done is I think that she has been more prepared for her daily briefings. And I think that is evident in some of the answers that she gives, not necessarily on the most contentious subjects of the day, but when people say things like, well, what is the president hoping to accomplish with his event tomorrow? She seems to be prepared to answer that question and doesn't just appear to be making it up on the spot. And too often, I do think that Sean was in a position where he was making it up on the spot. But, you know, to try to give him at least a little credit, I think that's because he was stretched too thin. He didn't have a team around him. There wasn't a communications director in place. And I think it showed, and I think it detracted from his ability to be a particularly effective advocate for the president. I don't think that was his only weakness, but I think it was an important one. And I think it does sort of illustrate why Sarah, at least publicly, is perceived as having somewhat more success than Sean did.
We're talking with Josh Earnest, who will be here in town next week at an event at UMKC called Former White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest Takes Your Questions, which is, in fact, what he is willing to do right now. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. What are your questions for President Obama's spokesperson a year after President Obama left the White House? It has been over a year. Does it seem that way, Josh?
It does seem that way.
You miss it?
to say that I, no, I would not say that I miss it. I would say that I look back on it with a lot of nostalgia. It was a life-changing experience to work in the White House and to serve as President Obama's press secretary for about the last 3 years or so. And what I, you know, there are so many things about that job that really appealed to me. One is, and going back to what we were talking about earlier, I actually really liked the opportunity to influence the broader debate in Washington, D.C. There are not many people, even elected officials in Congress, for example, even a sitting United States senator doesn't have the same kind of platform that the White House press secretary does. It's the White House press secretary who goes out there and answers questions for a period of time every day. The entire media shows up.
Right.
And, you know, if it's a newsy day, you're going to be live on television answering those questions. And having the opportunity to do that day after day after day is a really powerful way to influence the debate. Now, it's important not to get confused when you're fulfilling that responsibility. People aren't showing up to hear what you have to say as the White House press secretary because they think that you, in my case, Josh Earnest, is all that interesting.
Yeah.
They're showing up, and it's important to have a little humility about this. They're showing up not because of who you are, but because of who you represent. With that humility in mind, there is an opportunity to put your own imprint on those broader arguments and to raise the kinds of issues and to tailor your arguments in a way that you feel like people are going to find them to be most persuasive. And you know, the truth is, Brian, this is actually where I drew on a lot of my own background, having grown up in a place like Kansas City. Having grown up in the show me state where people aren't just going to take your word for it. They expect you to marshal some evidence and to present some facts and to make a structured, cogent argument about what you're doing. And, you know, I think in some ways it's a little old fashioned, but it's also something that I tried to keep in mind when I was preparing for the briefing every day, not to get caught up in the bluster and the hubbub. And the perceived glamour of being on television every day, but actually trying to roll up my sleeves and get immerse myself in the kinds of facts that I felt like would be most persuasive, not the people with a strong partisan attachment, but the people who are actually trying to find out what their senior officials in government were trying to do every day.
So how are you adjusting then to life after the White House? I mean, you do not have that kind of opportunity really in anything else, although you are still on TV, you're still getting to talk about politics.
Yeah, and I often joke to people that now that I'm speaking for myself, people care a lot less about what I have to say every day when I'm appearing on television. And it is true that the stakes are a lot lower. An appearance on television when you're representing the White House, has the potential to, cause a diplomatic situation. Which is something that we've seen occur a couple of times in this White House, sort of move markets. The stakes are not quite as high. The margin for error is somewhat bigger now that I'm a private citizen and sharing my own views. But I certainly do appreciate the opportunity that I continue to have to contribute to the debate. But it doesn't drive the debate as much mm-hmm. as it did when I was in the White House. And like I said, that makes the job a little easier now. But in some ways, it's a little more fun. There aren't as many guardrails, as it were, when you're when you have a sort of official responsibility.
Is the work you're doing commenting on MSNBC? Is that your full time gig at the moment? I mean, what does the future hold for you down the road? What does a former White House press secretary do?
Yeah, I'm spending some time thinking about that and talking to some other people about potential opportunities in the business world. But I'm always going to have an interest in politics, and having an opportunity to comment about politics and add my own observations is something that really appeals to me. I'm always looking for ways that I can be helpful to other people who continue to pursue a career in politics. So one of the things that I've been doing is I've been serving on the advisory board of Let America Vote. Kansas City's own Jason Kander has set up this political organization to fight for voting rights. And so I've enjoyed the opportunity to try to support him and offer him some advice as he's stood up that organization. I've been supportive of some of the efforts at the Democratic Governors Association to put their plans in place to prepare for the midterm elections. And, earlier this week, I had an opportunity to speak to a group of about four dozen House Democrats at their weekly caucus meeting up on Capitol Hill the night before the State of the Union to talk a little bit about some of what their messaging strategy headed into the State of the Union.
How to spin afterward.
How to spin afterwards, but also how to You know, when you know, one of the things that I have firsthand experience with is trying to maximize the opportunity that any president has to command the attention of the country and the Congress in delivering the State of the Union address. It can be a little daunting if you're a member of Congress in the minority trying to respond to that and making sure that your voice is heard in the broader debate that's being started by that, kicked off by that speech. And, you know, so we had some good conversations about that. And that was a way that I felt like, I'm no longer involved, 12, 14 hours a day in the political debate. But I do have an opportunity to take the experience that I had in working in the White House and use it to offer advice to those who are still on the fight every day. And that's a really good opportunity and a way for me to stay active on some of these issues that I still feel quite passionate about.
816-235-2888. That's the number to call to talk with Josh Earnest, the former White House press secretary. Let's talk with Spencer in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Spencer.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing great.
So wonderful to talk to you. Josh, I have a quick question. In my opinion, from my viewpoint, one of the main traits of the Obama administration was that it was really marked by pragmatism and professionalism that we're not really seeing anymore. In the new Trump era, it really feels like world-class public servants with education and experience and skill like yourself have really kind of made a departure from the executive branches and our institutions in general. What do you think that we do about that? And how do you think that we really rebuild the skill base in our institutions?
Great question, Spencer. Thanks so much. Josh?
Spencer, thanks for the question. I do think that's a really insightful question. And, President Obama would tell you that he did make it a priority to try to put to sort of raise people's expectations about public service and the kind of competence and professionalism that people could expect in public service, and to restore this idea that there is, not restore this idea, but continue to reinforce this idea that there's dignity in public service. And I think he felt a personal responsibility to try to live up to that high standard, and he certainly expected the people who worked closely with him to live up to that standard as well. And to be real blunt about it, Spencer, I think that people took that for granted. And I do think that there is a broader appreciation now for people who welcome the opportunity to serve the public and view that with a sense of responsibility, a sense of humility, a sense of selflessness. I don't think that the Trump era has embodied that. I think that is among the most stark contrasts. Even setting aside sort of the policy differences or ideological differences that have been made. And, part of why I say that is a prevailing view of Republicans in Washington, D.C., that they feel quite let down and in some cases even outright embarrassed by the conduct of the president and senior officials in his administration.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, that's been in the news very much just this week, for example, with the White House supporting the release of this confidential memo from the House Intelligence Committee. The belief that it might suggest that the president is seeking cover to fire some of his own political appointees out of the Justice Department. When you think back on your own White House experience, what do you think of something like that?
Well, what has happened with the effort by the Trump administration and by some Republicans in Congress to politicize the process of conducting an independent criminal investigation is deeply, deeply disturbing. In some ways, Brian, the best example of this is the resignation or retirement of the deputy director of the FBI that was just announced this week, a man named Andrew McCabe. Mm-hmm. He is somebody who came under withering assault by the president of the United States on his Twitter feed. And we'll talk about the reasons why in a second. But the fact that you would have the president of the United States criticizing directly a career professional who signed up to serve in law enforcement at the FBI is in and of itself something that is quite concerning, particularly when you consider the fact that the president himself is under investigation. But that is compounded by the fact that the reason that the president was criticizing this individual was not because of anything that he had done in the course of his job, but because he happened to be married to somebody who was a Democrat and who had run for office for the state Senate in the state of Virginia. That is the reason that the president criticized him and suggested that this career professional, Andrew McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI, was unfit for his job and unable to exercise his own discretion because he was married to a Democrat and was unable to ensure that his political views weren't tainting or interfering with the conduct of his official responsibilities. It's chilling, Brian, the idea that the deputy director of the FBI can lose his job because of the partisan affiliation of the person that he's married to I don't want to be overly dramatic about this. And I think my public persona is to indicate that I'm not somebody who is prone to hyperbole or overly dramatizing events in the news. But it is deeply concerning that somebody who is as influential as a deputy FBI director can lose his job because of the partisan affiliation of the person that he's married to. Is really, really concerning. And it represents a stark departure from a longstanding bipartisan tradition of Democratic and Republican presidents making sure that that criminal investigations aren't tainted even by the appearance of a political interference.
And I should note that just in the last few minutes, news organizations are reporting that the memo has been released that I was mentioning, and so it's now out there, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that from NPR at the top of the hour. Let's take one more call from Leslie in Mission Hills. Leslie, welcome to Up to Date.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Good morning. I really think the last point overrides the earlier point, but I'm going to stick to the earlier point, which was that you made, Josh, the voice that gets lost, you know, that you articulate that. And Brian's going to have in the next segment the whole issue of people getting involved in the labor fight and you know, sort of creating some of the issues around inequality. And that voice feels like it gets lost. How do you command when you don't have the bully pulpit and you don't have the legislators behind you in Congress that voice? And, you know, it happens in part because we're all just numb from the second point that you just finished making, Josh. So I just wanted to raise that up. It's the question of the day for the opposition, but not just in politics, the people who sit on the issues. And that's what I'd love if you could address. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie, and thanks for the forward promo for the next part of the show. But how does a voice, and really, whether regardless of your political affiliation, how does a voice cut through the cacophony and get heard and really get involved?
Yeah, look, there are so many things that have changed about our government with the transition from the Obama administration and the Trump administration, both in style and substance. But there is one fundamental thing that hasn't changed, which is that public representatives continue to be sensitive to pressure from their constituents. And ultimately, for all of the debate and noise that is that seems to be invited by the president and his administration, the one thing that we know makes a difference are constituents making their voices heard, contacting their elected officials, making sure that that those elected officials are aware of what they think about these issues, and just as importantly, that people are showing up on election day to make their voices heard and to make clear to those representatives what are the issues that you prioritize and what are the issues that you're voting on. And you know, for all of the reasons to be pessimistic about the state of our politics right now, I think that, you know, one of the silver linings is we have seen this dramatic increase in engagement all across the country among Democrats and Republicans, people who are well educated, and even people who don't have who don't have a college education. More people are turning into the news, and listenership at NPR is up.
So well, we certainly think that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. People are looking for ways to be better informed. You know, circulation at newspapers is up. Even viewership of cable news is up, and that's in some cases that's a double-edged sword. But at least it is an indication that people are interested in the debate around these issues. And the more that people are engaged, the healthier our democracy is going to be.
Before we let you go, Josh, I want to ask you the really important questions. We're less than 2 weeks away from pitchers and catchers reporting to spring training. You are well known as a Kansas City Royals fan who had the privilege of seeing them win the World Series and come to the White House while you were the press secretary. What do you think of the Royals in 2018?
Yeah, look, I regularly refer to the Royals visiting the White House in July of 2016 as the highlight of my 8 years in the White House. And the fact that their World Series celebration coincided with my tenure as the White House press secretary is It's a bucket list remarkable item, moment of good fortune for me. But look, I the state of the Royals is much different now than it was even 2 years ago. And, you know, they are ready to embark on a what I think will be a multi-year rebuilding period. But if anybody in Major League Baseball has earned the benefit of the doubt about rebuilding a franchise and doing it the right way, it's Dayton Moore and his team. He has shown that he could do it once, and I think you could make a pretty good argument. They're actually building on a better foundation now than they were when he took over, 8 or 10 years ago. So, I don't expect that they're going to win nearly as many games this year as they did last year. And frankly, I would have liked to see them win more games last year. There's going to be rebuilding here. But look, there's also something appealing about looking at these younger players and, you know, building these assets and grooming them for success on the big stage. So it's a different kind of being a fan requires paying attention to some different things this time. But my support for them is not shaken, and I got a lot of confidence that Dayton Moore has what it takes to rebuild this team and bring us back.
That is Josh Earnest, the former White House press secretary and longtime Royals fan who is originally from Kansas City. He's coming back, by the way, next week, February 7th at 6:30 for an event at UMKC where he'll answer questions from the audience. It's a free event, but reservations are required. You can do that on UMKC's website. Josh Earnest, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Brian.
When we come back, we'll take a look at activism in Kansas City, and in particular, at efforts to put the people whose lives are being affected in the forefront of the movements to bring change. How does a movement really maintain its grassroots? I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver shared his reactions to the president's State of the Union speech. He talked about what he'll be working for in the House in the coming months. You can listen to that conversation again at kcur.org/up-to-date. And on Monday, we'll try to figure out what makes some TV theme songs so memorable and what accounts for the success of one local jazz club owner. Join us then. But today, political and social justice movements sometimes are criticized for failing to be inclusive of the people who are impacted the most, the people they're fighting for. And that's especially true with lower-income people. Lots of things can stand in the way: transportation, language differences, lack of internet access, or just the fact that they have to spend a lot of time working to make a living can all deter people from participating. One social movement with a strong local presence, though, has had a lot of positive attention, locally and nationally, for programs that really engage the people affected on the front lines. And one of their leaders is here with us today. Terrence Wise is a worker leader with Stand Up KC, which is fighting for a higher minimum wage and for workers' rights, part of the Fight for 15 movement. Terrence, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for having me today.
And also Rhiannon Dickerson. She's a UMKC lecturer on interpersonal and public communication. She's joining us, part of her work last fall. She organized Educate, Organize, Advocate, a conference focused on civic and community engagement. Rhiannon, welcome to you.
Thanks, Brian.
Let me start with you, Terrence. You are a second-generation fast food worker. You've worked at McDonald's, Burger King for most of your life. How did you end up involved with a movement?
Well, I think it's important for people to know that, yes, I am a second-generation fast food worker. I watched my mom work for Hardee's, a very profitable company here in America, for about 30 years. And I've worked in fast food and low-wage jobs for about 20 years. And I can tell you, before I started organizing here in Kansas City and across the country, I'd just go about my work life doing what my mom told me: work hard and everything will be okay. That's just a good old American dream. You work hard, you'll get ahead. But I noticed, even with my fiance and I raising three girls here in Kansas City, working full-time, two working parents, we continued to lose ground year after year. And I think it's important, because I learned, I didn't always know, that it's going to take movements to change all aspects of life, whether it's the workplace, whether it's change we want to see in our communities, anything that we want to see changed in our lives as individuals, we got to come together with others and build movements. And that's very important.
How did that come to be you? There's lots of fast food workers in Kansas City. How did it come to be that you got involved with Stand Up KC? Did someone come and invite you?
Well, I know fast food workers in Kansas City started organizing 5 years ago. Kansas City was one of the first seven cities in the U.S. to begin organizing fast food workers to win $15 an hour, not only a higher wage, but to have a union, a voice on the job, negotiating abilities with the corporations we work for. And workers came into my job, actually right down the corner from here, right down the street, and came in and asked me three simple questions. Do I think all workers deserve better wages? The answer was yes. Do workers deserve vacation, paid sick time? Yes. Do we deserve respect and dignity in the workplace? We all do, regardless of where you work. And those questions, I realized I was lacking all of those things in my workplace, and I wanted to win those things. And they invited me to join a movement, a fight for 15 in a union, and that's how I became involved early on.
And what has that led to? What have you done in this movement? What kind of leadership have you taken?
Oh, my goodness. I can tell you, for over the last 5 years, we've accomplished a great deal. And it's hard to look back because we got so far to go. But you got to look back at what we've been able to do.
What have you been able to do?
Me personally, I think for me personally, I've been able to not only learn to organize my community and my coworkers, but win respect in my workplace. That's number one, to gain power and ability to stand up and fight back. And the roads we've traveled, me personally, I've been able to not only travel abroad and across the globe organizing fast food workers, I've been able to go even to the White House, which we see as a victory here in this movement. I went to the White House not alone, but as a representative of Kansas City and all the 4 million fast food workers here in this country.
Well, in fact, that is a moment that a lot of people paid attention to, because you didn't just go to the White House, but you actually got to introduce the president as he spoke. In fact, we have a little clip of your speaking at the White House. Let's take a listen.
As long as working people go without food and shelter and utilities, we won't back down. My three little girls are worth more. This movement is about their future. We are honored that the president is joining us to lift up the voices of workers across America. If I can say that one more time. That'd be awesome. We are honored that the president is joining us today to lift up the voices of the workers across America. And I am proud to introduce the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
That was our guest today, Terrence Wise, introducing the president on a visit to the White House, which not too many people get to say they've done that.
No, and I can tell you, on sidebar, me and the president, Barack Obama, he told me, with no one listening, just me and him on the side, that with a pen and a pad, he can't make too much change here in this country. He can't make it all better. It's going to take movements. Average everyday workers, average everyday people coming together to move this country and move whatever we need to see changed in this country. And that's always stuck with me, something he told me.
And the other thing that he told you very publicly, right, as after you introduced him, was that guy could run for something. let me ask you, Rhiannon Dickerson from UMKC. You study these movements and how they work and what helps people to organize and be effective. How typical is Stand Up KC at involving people in the movement like they've involved Terrence?
Well, I think they're exceptional. I'm humbled to be here on the panel with Terrence. I would say that a lot of movements that have affected significant change historically have been led by folks like Terrence, by low-wage workers or by people of color and by women. So in that regard, I think Stand Up KC is in line with generations of advocacy.
What are some other examples?
Locally, we have an organization called the Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance, KS-MODA for short, and they are fighting for Dreamers and a Clean Dream Act, and that's another example. I would also recommend showing up for racial justice for folks who, white allies who want to get involved and help support ending white supremacy.
So while other manifestations of the Black Lives Matter movement might feature African Americans, there's places for allies to serve as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
I mean, what are examples? What's the alternative? What are some examples of organizations or movements that in your judgment you know, haven't been inclusive, haven't been intentional about putting the people who those movements are advocating for at the forefront?
You know, I don't have a lot of examples of that because I don't think that they've been particularly effective. I think in order for a movement to be effective, it needs to center the community that it hopes to serve. I think in the last couple of years, my involvement in social justice organizations or movements is me joining movements that pre-exist rather than sort of spearheading my own movement. So I've learned to listen. I think one of the first things that we should do as advocates is really listen to the folks who share their stories and who are so willing to take the kind of risks that that folks like Terrence take.
And why does that matter so much? I mean, if there's people who really are good at organizing, they know how to use media, they have some money behind them, they can change hearts and minds and make the lives of low-wage workers, let's say, better, why isn't that good enough? Why is it more effective to have people who are being affected at the forefront?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I think that a lot of times if you are not within a community and you're outside of it and you recognize that the community needs additional resources, a lot of times you can be what we call an interloper. So I think that if you are advocating for a community that you aren't naturally part of, that your first role in that community is to listen and to follow the leadership of folks who already know what they're doing. They know the issue firsthand. I think, you know, following the lead of those people who've been doing the work for a long time is pretty essential. I will also say that finding a variety of rhetorical tools is pretty important. So, humanizing the argument or, bringing in emotion. Data can only take you so far. Mm-hmm. So sharing the personal stories.
I mean, you've called them interlopers. I mean, can they do actual damage to the cause?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that does happen a lot of times. If you are, we could look at Kansas City, for example, where we see, east of Troost, we have disinvestment and redlining, and then some well-intentioned folks who may end up gentrifying those neighborhoods. So really, I think centering the communities who are most affected by whatever it is, whatever injustice you're trying to overturn, I think that's really essential.
I invite any of our listeners who want to join the conversation. Are there times when you've been part of a movement as an activist for your own rights or your own situation, or maybe when you've done that on behalf of others? Do you feel like you were an interloper? How do you think those two things are different? What else would you ask Terrence Wise and Rhiannon Dickerson? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Terrence, what else does Stand Up KC do to give skills and leadership opportunities for folks like you in the community that it's seeking to serve?
Well, I think that it's a part of the national movement that mm-hmm. we've been able to build. And I can say Fight for 15. Mm-hmm. And here in Stand Up KC and in Kansas City, we knew early on that we had to fight for racial and economic equality on all fronts. And I can tell you, when it comes to social justice and building a movement, you got to bring together your strength in numbers. And what's something that we all do every day, even you're doing right now? We're at work. That's where most Americans wake up and go every day. And if we can organize in our workplace, build our strength in numbers in the workplace, build that kind of power, then we have the ability to change everything. Better schools, better roads, better community, climate justice, all of that. And so Stand Up KC has been proud to be a leader in that. Within Stand Up KC and here in Kansas City, we've got several different groups inside of Stand Up KC that have been detrimental to building the movement and helping workers to share what life is like living on poverty wages and working full-time and still being in poverty. Recently, we had the Story Speaking Corps here in Kansas City, which is actually in year two. I was a graduate of the program last year. And Story Slam, which is an event we had last year, had about a dozen graduates. I was one. And it's just us working every week. We met every Sunday, some determined workers, to develop our ability to tell our stories and what it's like coming home to no food in the refrigerator and those type of situations.
And what's so important about storytelling? I mean, why is that a skill that's useful here?
Well, it's not a secret recipe. It's been our recipe since day one. The only way workers are going to win a union and win better pay is to organize their strength in numbers. That's number one. And number two is to stand up and tell their stories, to win the hearts and minds of the American people. And that's where Story Slam really plays a key part. And one thing that I have to even remind myself, when I hear workers like Kim in Kenya and Wes tell their stories of raising their children or dealing with medical problems in the workplace without health insurance or health care, when I hear their stories that touch me, I have to remember these are real people. These are Americans, and these are their lives that they're living.
And we should mention that there is an event coming up where some of these stories will be told. It's a little later this month, February 24th at 7 o'clock at St. Paul's Church. General tickets are $16. Low-wage worker tickets are free. And it's called Lives on the Line. What is that?
It's going to be an event similar to Story Slam last year. It'll be February 24th, as you mentioned. And workers have been working with Matthew Dix, who's a professional storyteller. You may have heard him on the Moth Radio Hour. He's been working with workers here in Kansas City, and he'll be back in Kansas City on February 24th to share with us as well. But it'll be about a dozen workers telling their stories of survival, grit, and determination. I'm telling you, you got to be there February 24th to hear these stories and hear how these workers are organizing under these odds and still winning here in Kansas City.
That's Terrence Wise. We're also talking with Rhiannon Dickerson. Rhiannon, you mentioned earlier one of the keys to being effective as an ally is to listen. What is that? Can you be more specific about that? What does that look like? I mean, where do you go to listen? To whom do you listen? How does one person plug into a movement when they're coming sort of from the outside?
Yeah, so in these days of social media, I think it's really easy to plug in to folks whose voices you might not have heard otherwise. The social media realm has, I think, given voice to a lot of people that we hadn't heard from historically. So I would advocate for a very diverse list on social media. That would be one way to start. And then, you know, I teach at UMKC, so I'm in a position where I get to hear many perspectives all of the time. And I think, you know, research is always pretty important. But if you join movements like Stand Up KC or KS Moda, you will be positioning yourself in such a way that you really can hear from people that you might, perspectives that you might not have considered before.
Yeah. Terrence, I want to ask you, as someone who's working awfully hard, not only at your job, but at this movement and at this effort, what do you say to folks who are not low-wage workers themselves, but who want to be supportive? Do you ever experience them to be, as Rhiannon said, interlopers?
Well, I just think you got to remind folks sometime that we're truly never free, not any one of us, until we're all free. So even if you feel like an issue doesn't affect you, trust me, we've all been going down, whether it's wages, whether it's our climate, whether it's our environment, and so many different aspects in this country, that the only way for us to turn it around, to right the ship, is to come together. And even if you feel like, well, my life's fine, trust me, if it's an injury to one, it's an injury to all. So if you seek true justice and you really care about not only the children, but your community as well, then you got to stand up for what's right. You just got to always be consciously ready to do what's right and stand up and fight for justice on any forum, any platform, any day.
You know, I think, Terrence, a lot of folks listening to you might have a question that almost comes off to me as a little bit offensive, but it actually grows from sort of what the president said to you, that you could run for something. You have acquired through this work all these skills, community organizing, communication, storytelling, to the point where, I mean, some might say you could be doing something besides working in fast food. How do you respond to that? How does that, what does that do to have someone say that? And what's your response?
Well, I know, I'm telling you, being a part of the movement and learning not only about this movement, but the civil rights movement, women's movements, voting rights movements, everything that comes, that it came before me, I knew that growing up, you know, I got that a lot growing up. I was in advanced classes. I was college bound. I was supposed to be this great writer. That's what I was supposed to be. But I know that God had a plan for me, and I think this is where he wanted me at, helping to lead a movement, helping to cause great change in this country. Because I always remember it's more of us, regular average day working Americans, than there are politicians. It's more of us than there are CEOs. So we have more power. I have more ability to affect change, not only in my life, but around the nation when I come with the movement or join others. That is the way. So I do take that question in stride, and I hear it a lot. But I know that what we're doing and the great work that we're doing here in Kansas City and nationally is where you want to be. You want to be on the ground with the folks that are really impacted by these issues.
We should mention there's another event that actually is coming up tomorrow. It's part of the five-year anniversary celebration, the 5 years of the Fight for 15 movement and of Stand Up KC. It's a fundraiser at Knuckleheads. Doors open at 7 and tickets are $15. You can find out about that event as well as the storytelling event at the Facebook page of Stand Up KC, where they've got more information. Rhiannon, one more question for you. You organized this conference I mentioned in introducing you, the Educate, Organize, Advocate Conference. That was last fall. Will there be another one?
Yeah, we've already started planning the 2018 conference. We are, you know, one of the strengths of the conference really is having so many voices on the planning committee from across UMKC. We have students who are involved in the planning, faculty and staff. We're fortunate to get the expertise from folks in multicultural student affairs and diversity and inclusion, Latinx studies, Black studies, you name it. We have a really robust committee who is working really diligently to plan the conference for October 2018. So we're excited about that.
That's Rhiannon Dickerson. She's a UMKC lecturer of interpersonal and public communication. She joined us along with Terrence Wise, a worker leader with Stand Up KC, which is fighting for a higher minimum wage and workers' rights, part of the Fight for 15 movement. Don't forget, you can find out more at the Stand Up KC Facebook page, both about their anniversary fundraiser event tomorrow and also February 24th, the Storytelling Slam, Lives on the Line. Terrence and Rhiannon, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really nice to have you here. If you missed today's conversation, any part of it, you can find it in podcast form at kcur.org/up-to-date. That also includes earlier conversations this week, including our visit with NPR's Wade Goodwin on Monday. So tune in or download for that. Our theme music was composed by Bobby Watson. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Coming up Monday, an earworm alert. We try to figure out what makes our favorite TV theme song so darn memorable. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Mike Russo, Chris Young, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Brian Ellison. Steve Kraske's back Monday, and you are up to date.